So, good morning, everyone. Wonderful to be here with you this soon-to-be snowy Saturday. I wanted to continue our exploration of this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that we have been looking into all week. And I wanted to continue looking at this section on bowing. Diane did such a lovely talk on this section last night. And she talked about where he says, but when you bow to Buddha, you should have no idea of Buddha. You just become one with Buddha. You are already Buddha. So, we are always Buddha. No exceptions. No need to have any idea of what that means. We simply bow as Buddha, to Buddha, just this activity of bowing. We're always Buddha, but this practice just helps us to realize we are not becoming Buddha, we are already Buddha. So there's this ocean of Buddha nature, this oneness, this emptiness side. And there's also the particular. And these may appear to be two different things, but actually one thing showing up in these two ways. And Suzuki Roshi goes on to say in this section, he says, when you cannot do anything except bow, you should do it. This kind of conviction is necessary. Bow with this spirit, and all the precepts, all the teachings are yours. So, sometimes circumstances are quite difficult, aren't they? Early in this retreat, I found out, as some of you may know, that my 86-year-old mother took quite a bad fall and broke her hip and had to be rushed to the hospital, and she had just the week or two before been on a heart monitor because she was having a lot of trouble with her heart and heart failure. And when I heard that she was going to need to undergo surgery and anesthesia, I was quite concerned. And there was really this feeling arose of helplessness. There was really not much I could do, and I was far away. She was at home south of Boston, and here I was on retreat out in Worcester, and nothing I could do. She was being taken care of, and I just sat in the middle of that feeling of helplessness and not being able to do anything. And Suzuki Roshi says, when you cannot do anything except bow, you should do it. Just bow down. Just surrender to the helplessness, the fear, this anxiety arising. Birth and death. And he says, bow with this spirit and all the precepts, all the teachings are yours. Just bow. When you can't do anything else, just bow. This surrender. Is an opportunity for me to get out of the way, to realize this spirit of not being able to by myself, that the activity is done by Buddha. A bit further on, he says, bowing helps to eliminate our self-centered ideas. This is not so easy. It is difficult to get rid of these ideas, and bowing is a very valuable practice. The result is not the point. It is the effort to improve ourselves that is valuable. There is no end to this practice. So this struck me as being quite a strange thing to say, right? We've been talking and talking about no need for self-improvement. How Zen is not a self-improvement project. Nothing that we need to fix in order to be right here. On this moment already, the Dharma Gate. We ourselves already Buddha. Under whatever circumstances are arising. But this this particular being in Shin Buddhism, they talk about foolish being. Filled with blind passion. All of our greed, anger, and ignorance. These are the self-centered ideas that become our karma. All evil karma ever created by me since of old, because of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, all of this evil karma somehow being mine, Buddha manifesting as this world of birth and death and joy and tragedy and feelings of separation. So powerful, this sense of being a separate individual and so easy to fall into behaviors that are harmful to ourselves and to others. This is where we need the precepts. This is the spirit of atonement, to really feel this. If we say, you know, we're already Buddha and everything is fine, no need for special effort. Sure, I just hurt someone, but it's all good. This spirit, I think, will not do. This is regret. Really feeling whatever it is that is arising, whether it's anger or anxiety, helplessness, meeting all of this, and sometimes we feel ashamed of ourselves. Sometimes we're it's quite apparent that we have acted badly, and there's this, I think, quite wonderful, sincere wish to do better. And I think this is part of our Buddha way, our way-seeking mind, bodhicitta, this desire to save all beings. And often it's to save all beings from me. So he says that the result of this effort to improve ourselves is not the point, right? This is where we miss the target, is we think that I can improve myself and no longer be subject to these difficulties, the arising of greed and anger and ignorance. And my experience is that this is not so much the case. That greed and anger and ignorance arise endlessly. And how do we meet these? How do we meet the results of these arisings? And this is why we have the precepts. So valuable, this effort to eliminate our self-centered ideas, to open ourselves to something that is beyond that. This foolish being filled with blind passions, just bowing, just surrendering, just atoning. And when I'm unable to do anything else, so very important just to bow. Thank you. So now we'll have our Dharma dialogue. Please sit comfortably, and opportunity for questions, discussion. Right.
I liked hearing your talk, and it struck me the bowing is as the fulfillment of the precepts, and I think bowing is an activity, you know, of when I bow, and then or and then I move, and then I do something. So it's about being first, acknowledging and meeting what arises. Then the activity, rather than sort of bowing as staying bowed, and it's the first step for me to the action. And this is my connection with meeting the precepts. The precepts are, oftentimes I find that there are ways of avoiding the moment, you know, the gossiping, the stealing, the lying, the getting intoxicated. The precepts, promote warn us against, and I find that oftentimes those kinds of strategies are ways of avoiding bowing to what I'm experiencing in the moment. So for me, again, that's the connection between fulfilling the precepts and bowing as a fulfillment of the precepts. So,
oh yeah, and of course these are useful strategies, right? So we can see them in that way as guides to our behavior. But you're pointing to something very much deeper here. This meeting the reality, right? And letting the activity unfold from there, because it's very important that we act, right? After I was sitting with this helplessness about my mother, right, I decided that even though there was nothing I could do, I needed to do something, right? And I rushed over to the hospital where she is, just south of Boston. I left retreat to be with her during the surgery, and I had this wonderful opportunity to be with her for a couple hours before she went in. You know, could have been her last couple of hours. Who knows? As it worked out, everything was fine, and she went through the surgery, and she was walked across the room yesterday with a walk. So, but we don't know, right? And we meet this moment, as you're saying, and then once we fully have met the reality of this moment, we move into activity. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Steve, for the talk. I also appreciate it, and I had similar thoughts to yours, Ray. And I really love that you told the story of your mother and that you actually did bow and then you acted. I think the mistake we make, and that's where the precepts sort of warn us about the possibilities of this, are acting first and bowing later. Which also happens anytime you can insert the bow, it's good. But I for some reason it really dawned on me, like, this real clarity about my unhappiness about the recent election. And if anybody's happy about the recent election, maybe you can just imagine what it was like for you 8 years ago when Obama got elected, so you can empathize with what I'm saying. But my, it's been impossible to bow to it. And just as you were talking, I could feel my body. It was really a physical experience. It was like saying, "This is real."
Right.
And then, and now what? Right? Because my mind's been trying to make, it's not true, it's not true, it can't be true, this is a nightmare, I'm going to wake up. And, you know, unless I've been sleeping for months, I haven't woken up yet. So in order to act, the bowing has to be deep and sincere. This is reality. I can't fight reality. And I can do something, right? Organize. And we have been doing things. You know, we've been talking and going to peace rallies and rallies to support people of the Muslim faith and all kinds of things. And Diane's going to go down to the march, right? Are you still doing that?
Yes.
The march in Washington, the Women's March. So there are things to do, but it's so important to really, really, really bow to reality. Really. Which also means bowing to my unhappiness, my frustration, my surprise and shock, all that. Yeah. Then something can happen. And that's Zen. You know, Zen is not, and you know, we definitely can misinterpret it. I think it's just the bowing.
Well, and it's really this both and, because the bowing is not a strategy.
Right, right.
You know, not, but rather an expression. And I love this bowing as saying yes to this great reality that it on one hand, of course, is so troublesome, you know, like such a problem, this world. But yet, when we bow to it, this teaching is that the world is the self. The world is Buddha nature appearing to us. But usually we want it a little different. No, I want it, you know, more hair or taller or shorter or whatever. But when we bow, then the whole world bows. The whole world reveals itself as the truth.
I mean, there is something very profound in this bowing to reality, and I thank you for your talk on that. You used another word in your talk that I think can be problematic, which is surrender. Mm. It seems to me that next to a lot of Dharma gates, there's also a fool's gold version. There are versions of surrender, which is how cults get started. So I wondered if you could comment on that.
Yeah, that kind of surrender you're talking about, sometimes we have a phrase for that in Buddhism, it's the near enemy of real surrender, which is this real saying, well, the saying yes to reality. But that kind of surrender is foolish, right? It's delusive certainty in the sense that it's saying that this other person knows more than I do, and I should surrender to their view. Mm-hmm. Or what they tell me, and we're so not all of us, but some of the teachers in Boundless Way, I think you've been saved from that, Steve. We're students of other teachers before we found Boundless Way, mm-hmm. and those teachers demanded a kind of surrender, just do what I say, right? And that we don't do that. We have a safety valve because there's a number of teachers. Right, so if you go to one teacher and they tell you do this, and then you go to the next teacher and they say, no, don't do that, do this. And then you go to the third teacher, oh no, that's not it. You've got to realize that the efficacy comes from internally. It's internal rather than external. So there's a way of saying yes to reality that is a surrendering of the wish for it to be different, although even that, the wish, you have to also surrender and say yes to the wish for
it. I forgot, I wish to be different.
Yes, it's terrible. Yeah. So this bringing all of our clarity and compassion to the surrender. It's not just mindless, delusive surrender or mindless, delusive bowing. It's a way of life of saying yes. And the saying yes isn't saying, oh, great, good, this is good. Now, I'll get around to it. I'll accept this. Acceptance is another problematic word, right? I'll accept this. It's not about any of that. It's just going. It's just being realizing that the fight against reality is always hopeless, because reality always wins that fight. Right? So there's some kind of a bowing to that. Does that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's where you were mm-hmm. going to.
Yeah. And I think there is this danger that you speak of, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was, I guess I was 17, I was engaged in a search for a perfect master, right? And mm-hmm. shopping around looking for who that person might be that could guide me in the midst of all of my suffering, right? And to give myself over to someone who knew better than I did. And for whatever reason, that never actually took place. I came very close. I was going to join the Hare Krishnas, actually, and hand out flowers in airports.
Yeah, I could see that.
Ponytail.
But I think that, you know, something that has served me well in my Zen practice, I went and actually, you know, visited these people with the intention of making this place my home. And I got this feel of the cultishness of, you know, so everybody has this mindless devotion to this one one thing, you know, and that my doubt and inability to, you know, so this is not bowing, right? I couldn't just bow down to this cultish thing, right? I needed to be true to myself, right? And that's the wonderful thing in our Zen practice, right? We say it all the time, you know, don't believe what the teachers say, right? Find out for yourself. This is really, really important that of course we listen and hope to learn, but we verify it ourselves, right? This is true for me, not, you know, not something that you say. So thank you, Julie.
And I love just this little story of, so we're saying, oh yeah, bowing, bowing. And Steve saved himself by objecting.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. First in a long series. Yeah.
Never stop objecting.
So there's a bowing to objecting. In the sense that when objecting comes up for you, don't step over it. Mm-hmm. The point here is not about, oh, I'm supposed to bow, but what is arising. So when objection arises, trust that there is some truth and importance about that. It doesn't mean you act on it. It doesn't mean anything, except in that moment there's some truth happening in the form of objecting. So we bow to objection and then discern what to do. Oh, I need to talk to the teacher because that doesn't make sense to me. Or I need to get out of here. Or I need to come back. You know, there is that, you know, this surrender is being with what's here, and objecting is sometimes what's here. And thank goodness that each one of you has an inner guidance system, that when it's bullshit or when it's not true, something arises. And now, of course, we object to lots of things, and sometimes we then get familiar with the one who is objecting. So who is the one that's having such a problem? And wonderful Dharma game.
I just want to speak to another aspect of this whole thing. This isn't a disagreement with it, but sort of another way of framing it. Because every once in a while as a teacher, I get tired and I say, just do what I say already. I'm like a little devotional. What's the problem? Why don't you just be devotional to me? I'm not really asking for it. We get into trouble. But there is. I was just talking to someone about who was very upset, and you know, in the objecting, that this healthy objecting place, about the practice, and they said something that I thought was really interesting. I can't do what you are asking me to do until I know exactly what's going to happen when I do it. And I was like, whoa, you can't know that. You actually have to trust me. This is an area that you don't know anything about. I've been in the forest for years, and you just entered the forest. I can actually show you some pathways so that you could have a better experience of the forest. It's kind of like that. So it's that we value the objecting, but every once in a while, I think that there's some kernel of this in what David was just saying. When we really meet the objecting part of ourself, it can open to a trust, and objecting goes away. There's no longer anything to object to. And maybe this other person sitting across from you is not a fake and not an idiot, Maybe there's something that you could learn. Who knows? So it's flexible. There's no rule book. Number one, always object. Number two, then surrender. It's not like that. It's a very flexible experience being a student of the way.
Well, it's this middle way. Right?
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's a good term.
I like that.
Copyright. The Buddha. This middle way that's not a sort of blending everything into gray, but right circumstance, right action.
Yeah.
Well, my experience is with that is not anything I can talk about specifically, but what is so amazing about this and about being here and about everyone listening and about all you people sharing is that it reveals how subtle this is to me. And it like, I can go to 50 dokusans, or I can just sit here for half an hour and absorb so many things that some I have to take away and go chew on for a little while, and others it's just such a safe place. I know I always say this, but the objector that you were hearing can say that. And for some reason, that's just where they are. Mm-hmm. And that's where I find myself very often and not able to articulate it. But I can feel it in my body and can see it in the teacher's eyes, you know. And so it's just, it's more than a venue. I don't know.
Well, but I think there is something that we create together, this Sangha practice, where all of us maybe dare to let more come forward, that we consider the possibility of moving out of the control business or the self-improvement. I just have to get rid of this and then. And so then the teaching is everywhere. So if everything is Buddha nature, then everything, even what we've excluded, maybe especially what we've excluded, and it comes forward. So as we sit in the meditation hall, we are teaching and we are receiving the teaching. And we can't tell the difference. We say teachers and students, but of course we're all both. When you sit upright in your posture and return and again, you are preaching the Buddha Dharma. This is each one of us manifesting and supporting each other. And this safety you talk about is so precious to see that, to perceive this. Thank you.
So this morning I've been realizing a little more how it's all practice in sesshin, the samo and the eating and the brushing my teeth and sleeping. And then, of course, I think part of this training is to carry our practice with us outside of sesshin and recognize, acknowledging the universal Buddha nature. And I think on Monday, and I work at an office, just myself, and I gotta type my email. And then I hit send. But that, bringing that, it's a pause. The bow is a chance to pause, acknowledge the universal nature of Buddha in all things. And whether it's an imaginary bow or a real bow. Bring it with me.
I think it's so important that we're not just talking about some physical activity. We're talking about a movement of the heart that can be expressed physically in many different ways. Thank you.
And I think you can have a very busy job, and there are moments in the day when you can just feel the phone against your ear, or just, you know, hitting that keyboard. You know, like your practice can infuse your busy day and all these like micro moments that kind of transforms the day from, oh, this is something, you know, out here separate from my practice. So I used to do that a lot. Before I retired, but you'll retire someday too.
Yeah, love it.
Can you tell a little bit more about the actual bowing? Because for me it's like nothing and everything. Like in some way I don't know why and what I'm doing, and I love it, and I am. And in all the teachings I hear, like, don't have an idea about the Buddha you're bowing to, or if you're the Buddha, and who is the Buddha, or and then the goal is to experience non-duality in awareness and as enhance selfless compassion. And then in the taking refuge and also in the bowing, then to me it's like a bowing to reality or bowing to not knowing. Or,
yeah. And what's the problem?
I'd like to hear some more of your words about the actual bowing. Is it different from taking refuge, or is it?
So actually, I think you're in a wonderful place about it. That it is not a thing, right? It is some kind of unfolding that reveals itself in the activity. So this, I love, you know, all the different ways, and so we're saying have no idea about bowing, and yet we're blabbing on and on and on about this no idea. So I guess just to appreciate this limitless engagement, there is some mystery here we are taught that our practice will teach us how to practice, and that our bowing will teach us how to bow, and to trust this great mystery. And in a sense, whatever you're thinking as your bowing is, that you're doing is wrong. So if you think, oh, I'm bowing to the universe, I mean, well, so that's nice. But I guess for me to consider there is some mystery that is demonstrated and completed and fulfilled.
So if I could just say one little thing about that, okay? Because sometimes, for me, bowing is just bowing. Right. It's not actually required that I feel a special way about it, or that I realize the emptiness, or that I'm bowing to everything. Sometimes I really don't like it. You know, somebody says something to me, you know, gives me an instruction, and I'm not too happy about it, and they bow, and I bow. And this is true bowing, right? It is bowing in this moment.
But to take the book serious, then if it is reality, then...
Yes, it's reality, and I'm bowing to it. But I don't have to feel special.
No, it is you are instructed to it.
Yes.
Well, you know, you don't have to agree, but you're instructed to...
Yeah, right. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
And you know, I think part of all this is that it doesn't matter what we're thinking when we're bowing.
No.
It actually doesn't matter. We can think all kinds of stuff. But there is something, this practice of Zen is very physical. Mm. So we're all sitting in the Zendo, being still, and you know, all kinds of things are happening in the mind. Well, I'm just talking about myself, right? There must be at least one of you that has other things. And the mind can come in and say, oh, good meditation, bad meditation. Now I'm really doing just sitting. Now I'm really, I have clarity in my koan, whatever. That's all contained in a way within the upright sitting. And the bowing is like that too. So we can have all these ideas, But the bowing trumps everything else. It supersedes everything else. I can't use that word anymore. It's a great word. It used to be a great English word, but not anymore. So it supersedes, right? It's more than all the stuff going on. The hands. It's sort of like what we were talking about last night. How you just know the body. Laura said the body just knows what to do, and so we let the body do it first. And then something happens. The attitude of sitting upright, something happens. The attitude of inclining at the waist, something happens. So we don't have to know what it is. And that's, you know, that's great faith in a way. That's one of the hallmarks of Zen. Great faith, great doubt, and great determination.
On that note, we will sit for a few more breaths and then move into walking.